Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World interview recorded on the 26th of July 2021, and I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman, and I'm delighted to be joined here today by Andrew Hollingworth, founder and fund manager of the VT Holland Advisors Equity Fund. Holland Advisors both run this fund and provide an investment analysis service to portfolio managers and CIOs. Andrew, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the launch of the Retail UCITS Fund. How's the fund performed year to date, well, calendar year to date? I know this will be part of the old Farnham Street Fund and what's now become the UCITS Fund, but how's it performed?
There's all sorts of rules and regulations about what you're supposed to say. There's a fact sheet that goes on the website. I think it was on the website on the 21st of June. And that fact sheet says, so I can't get into trouble for anything, that says that the fund is up 12% year to date. I think it's up 45% for the year prior to that, and then it's up 24% for the 2 years prior to that. So that's, I can't get into trouble for saying that because that's on the fact sheet on the 21st of June. And then the other facts and figures is that the NAV is pretty much unchanged for today as of the day that we recorded this interview, between today and the 21st of June. So that's all facts and figures.
Tremendous, because you target something like 12 to 14%. So you're well outstripping that or on a par with that for this year. So that's brilliant. Congratulations. So all of us are a little bit worried about inflation. How are you feeling about inflation? We're seeing it all around us. The economists are saying that it's just temporary, and as investors we're not sure how to position. What are you up to?
I think when we've spoken before, you've heard me talk about sort of my investment process as being like driving a car, whereby I sort of mainly look out the front of the car in terms of you spend 90% of your time looking for stock selection and sort of 10% of the time sort of looking in the wing mirrors, and the wing mirrors are sort of what's happening in the investing world around you. And yes, I think if you look in the wing mirrors, it does feel like there's a possibility of inflation rearing its head. And I think that sort of is a possibility. It's not a definite outcome, but I think it's a possibility. I think the only thing I would say is, I think if you own bonds, if you own equities that are highly valued and potentially have got slow growth or sort of moderate growth ahead of them, or if you own real estate investment trusts, then you know you've got to be pretty careful, because you could end up with a derating of the equities that you own or the assets that you own. I don't own any of those entities. There's a possibility that's why I've underperformed the S&P for the last 5 years, because if I'd owned all of those things, I'd have significantly outperformed, because they have sort of ridden the wave, if you like, of low interest rates. And so I think people that have sort of performed extremely well in a sort of rate compression environment are sitting there really worried about inflation coming along, because it will probably mean interest rates rise and that rate compression will reverse itself. But I think that's not how I've invested, and it's not how I do invest. I invest in an absolute way, thinking about all interest rate environments. And I don't remember who it was, and I wouldn't be appropriate if I did, but I listened to an investor the other day say something along the lines of, well, we should do pretty well as an investment firm if interest rates don't rise too much. And I sense that I think as an investment manager, you need to think about all different scenarios, even if interest rates rise. So I look at my investments in absolute, both in terms of the absolute price I pay for them and the absolute returns that they will produce. So we've got a number of investments like JD Weatherspoon, like Ryanair, that are basically businesses that have done really well in deflationary environments because they charge the customer less for the products that they sell. But they'd also do really well in an inflationary environment because they can basically put up prices quite easily if in an inflationary environment. And companies like Schwab that we own, you know, Schwab is a business that is a sort of GARP type stock. It's a business that, you know, is growing over time and is a sort of predictable growth stock. But it's also a business that is exposed to, like the banks are, higher sort of net interest margin. So if interest rates were to rise, a business like Schwab or Jarvis that we own in the business in the fund as well would benefit from higher interest rates. So I think what you want to be trying to do is not owning assets that are exposed to this sort of interest rate cycle, but have the occasional free option. So we own Jarvis because it's the lowest cost producer in terms of stock trading, if you want to do that, or stock asset custody. But where is interest rates to rise, you know, Schwab would make more money. So we're sitting there on sort of trying to have the occasional free option, but not sitting there with assets exposed to interest rate sensitivity. So I just think you just have to think about these risks occasionally. But that's how we look at it. But we don't worry about it, you know, untowardly.
So we haven't only got inflation, but we've also got COVID. And you were really prescient around COVID, spotting it in February last year and acting on that. How do you think it's going to play out from here?
I mean, in terms of being prescient, all we really saw was a risk coming that we just think the Western stock markets were just a little bit too relaxed about. And we owned a number of shares in terms of the leisure and transport sector that ordinarily we've been very happy to own long term, things like Ryanair and Wetherspoons and so on, that were businesses that we liked long term, that we just thought the risk reward on those businesses looked awful in the face of a pandemic. So we made, you know, unusually some sort of short term decisions to go to sort of 20% cash in February 2020, which is something that we wouldn't ordinarily do. But it just felt like the stock markets were being very flippant with what could have been a really significant risk, and disappointingly from a global perspective we were right in that sense, because it did become a big risk. Now, did I think it was going to go on for 18 months? Of course I didn't, and probably neither did you or anybody else in the world, but it obviously has gone on for much longer than we all thought. I'm a little bit reluctant in all truth to give my view on COVID, because I think it's just such an emotional subject that people get very upset when you have an opinion that disagrees with their own. There's a little bit of me that thinks that it stopped being a pandemic and became a panic at some point, just in terms of political decision making and so on. And I'm a bit reluctant to say that, because as I said, I think people can take it the wrong way. And I think in terms of investment policy decision making, I think people get a little bit stuck in sort of recency bias, where they make a decision on something that's a long-term decision according to what happened to them yesterday or the day before. And I'm not trying to belittle what's happened. I'm just trying to learn from the likes of Munger and others that have lived through many, many, many difficult times in their lives, and trying to make good decisions. And that's all we've tried to do in running the fund in the last year or 18 months or so, is just trying to sort of say, look, these things do pass. And whether that be 9/11 or whether that be pandemics or whether that be 2009, you know, I've lived through a few of these, and it's bloody unpleasant. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on these calls or not, but it is bloody unpleasant when it's happening, and you've just got to try and make the best of you can of it at the time. And it does feel like we are at the very back end of it, and it does feel like we've achieved some remarkable things with the vaccine, and it does feel like we might be at the very end of this wave. And I think that the interesting bit for me is things like the savings ratio and things like the sort of strength of character and the strength of desire that people are showing in certain parts of the world to want to get on with their daily life, to want to travel, to want to go to hotels, to want to go to theatres, whatever it is. There will always be people that don't and people that are reluctant. But for each one of those that's on the news, there are lots and lots of people that do want to do things. And I think as an investor, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for the return to normality of a large number of people, if you're looking for things that might be mispriced that you can get back to normal on. And that's all we've tried to do in maybe investing in Greggs or investing in Wetherspoons or investing in other companies. It's just trying to back good businesses at a point in time when others maybe thought they were never going to recover. And we're not trying to be ruthless about that or uncaring about that. We're just trying to invest our savers' money as well as we can.
So with Young's and Wetherspoons, are you happy that you have held throughout the pandemic? And are you happy that you're still holding now?
You know, Young's and Wetherspoons are interesting, because they are actually in the same sector, but they're two different rationales for why we own them, actually. In the sense that Wetherspoons is a sort of scale economy shared business that's run by an owner manager. And so by scale economy shared, I'm sure maybe most of your Listeners might understand what that means. So the bigger they get, the more they give back in terms of lower prices to the customers that go into the pub. So it's what Costco do, it's what Amazon do, it's what Greggs do in that sense. And that is the same in about a third of our portfolio. So about a third of our portfolio is that same business model, which is Greggs, which is Ryanair, which is Jarvis, in terms of low cost dealing and so on. So that falls into that business model, if you like. It just happens that Wetherspoons is in the pub sector, and it's the only pub that does that. And it just happens that it's also run by an owner-manager in terms of Tim Martin, as are all pretty much the 30% of stocks that fall into that sort of bucket of companies that we look for. Young's just happens to be in the same sector, but Young's was very much a sort of opportunistic purchase of, during the pandemic, a great freehold bunch of assets in one of the best capital cities in the world during a pandemic, which, when we thought those assets were depressed in value, when we thought those assets would recover in value. Now, those that are familiar with Young's will know that Young's has two classes of shares. It has a voting class of share and a non-voting class of share. We bought a bit of each of those classes of share during the pandemic. Now we only own the non-voting class of share. And the reason why that's the case is because the voting class of share has recovered it has recovered completely to £16 a share, which is where it was pre the pandemic. The non-voting class of share has not recovered hardly at all. So the non-voting class of share is £9 a share, and the voting class of share is £16 a share. The difference between the two of them is only the fact that you can't go to the AGM, and therefore you don't get a biscuit when you go to the AGM. That is it.
So why the difference?
The difference is because there's an arbitrage. The non-voting class of share is a little bit more illiquid. And pre the pandemic, there was about £2 difference in terms of valuation between the two of them. Today, there's about an 80 to 90% difference. So in due course, we don't think that difference is going to be there for very long. That's why we hold on to the Young's non-voting share. So it's a very different, you've picked up two stocks in the same sector, but there are different reasons why we own them. They're not an easy share for people to buy, but I don't think that Young's non-voting share price will be there for very much longer.
Very interesting. So over the last 6 months, have you changed any holdings in the funds because of COVID?
Your questions are interesting, because I think obviously there was seeing COVID coming is the wrong way to look at it. But we sort of had that slight risk-reward view in February 2020, where we went to 20% cash. We then reinvested that money sort of June 2020, and therefore, you know, when the stock market collapsed, and we then purchased things that we thought would recover, but we didn't know when the recovery was going to come. But then what happened, as you're sort of alluding to, I think, is the fact that obviously COVID's gone on for longer than we all anticipated. So what I think you've got to be really careful of is that, and I forget who said it, but there's an expression, I think it was one of the racing drivers or something a long time ago, but there was an expression that says, you know, to finish first you must finish. You can't win the race if you don't finish the race. And that has been an expression in our mind in the sort of COVID recovery plays, because there are certain COVID recovery plays that don't burn cash and certain recovery plays that do burn cash. So, for example, EasyJet does burn cash, but Wetherspoons doesn't. Greggs doesn't, because it's a freehold estate. Greggs doesn't really burn that much cash. We purchased Beijing International Airport, which is not on our top holdings. We own Mandarin Oriental, which is the freehold hotel estate. Again, it's not on our top holding list. But we purchased those because they're recovery plays, but they're asset heavy recovery plays that are not massive cash burners, or they've got a very asset heavy balance sheet, if you like. So to answer your question, I suppose what we sort of tried to do was be very cognizant of businesses that the longer COVID took to sort of work its way through the recovery process, would the businesses that we own effectively run out of cash, or would they have diluted rights issues? So there was a period of time when we did own EasyJet, and we think EasyJet's a really interesting business model, but we were just worried that EasyJet would just have to have a really, you know, dilutive rights issue, and we just couldn't be certain about that, if you like, you know. And there were other businesses that were just, we own Jet2, for example, and there were other businesses we were just happy with the balance sheet situation, that they just wouldn't either burn as much cash, or they'd raise cash preemptively and therefore would be more resilient for longer. And I think that was really, really important to us. And the other side of it we looked at is there was a period of time when the stock market got very fearful of inflation and therefore sort of rewarded a lot of either fearful of inflation or got very embracing of COVID recovery and therefore sold off some of the sort of secular growth companies. So things like Facebook, for example, we then invested in, did a lot of work on that in the sort of the beginning part of the year and actually thought it was a secular growth company, it was too cheap. And so purchased the shares in what we thought was a secular growth company when it was sold off too quickly. So we sort of, we didn't intentionally go against the stock market for the sake of it, but we just found periods of time when we just thought either secular growth was sold off too cheaply or the cyclical side of the stock market was being a bit too generous considering how fast the cash burn was going. So we just tried to be a little bit pragmatic and not too dogmatic, much as we believe in the cyclical recovery and the transport and leisure recovery. You know, we're fighting a tough beast in terms of a recovery that we can't be absolutely certain when it will arrive.
So just going back to Facebook, I'm interested that you've got three US holdings, one of your largest, Big Lorry and RCI Hospitality and Facebook, and then a French-based Belor. Doesn't it need rather a large bandwidth to cover off global markets rather than focusing on, say, just the UK or the US? How do you manage that? And what's the benefits of including the wider markets? And then what are the downsides?
Well, I don't look at it that way, actually. We only own 27 shares. So we run a pretty limited portfolio. I mean, there's plenty of portfolio managers that own 50, 100 shares. So, you know, I've got 27 shares to look at, not 50 or 100. The other thing I'd say is that a lot of these companies have got more in common than you might think. So, you know, so I don't look at sectors. I don't look at geographies. I look at sort of, as Munger would talk about, sort of mental models. So, you know, the simple thesis is we look at for sort of two types of things. We look at secular companies that are priced to fade. So in that sense, Facebook and Boohoo are very similar businesses. They're growing really fast, but the stock market thinks they're going to fade. Okay, there's a lot more to both Boohoo and Facebook than that, but simplistically, they're very similar in that regard. Okay, we also look for sort of depressed compounders, so businesses that have been compounding for many, many years, but then they're set to recover. So VP PLC, Dark Group, that's now Jet2, Brembo are all actually very similar businesses and very similar business models. And in both of those groups, both by way of the secular growers and the depressed compounders, we look for owner managers. And in Belor that you've highlighted, and in Big Lorry that you've highlighted, and in VP, and in RCI Holdings, and in Frasers, and in Jet2, every single one of those that's on our top shareholder list, every single one of them has an owner manager, no matter what country they're in. Okay. And in Belor, that's in France, and in Big Lorry, that's in the US, they're both very similar, complex conglomerates run by very charismatic, unusual, slightly opaque, slightly difficult individuals. On both companies, we think the share count is wrong. So that we think that actually Yahoo Finance and Bloomberg, in fact, has got the market cap wrong. So when it comes to calculating the intrinsic value of the business, we think that some of the people that cover the company have got the intrinsic value of the company wrong. So you know, there's a lot of similarities. And when, if you talk about what people like Munger and Buffett talked about, how they found companies, they talk about the mental models they use to go across boundaries. So earlier on, I talked about the sort of scale economy shared and how we see that in the same model between Ryanair and between, you know, Schwab and between JD Weatherspoon and so on. And it's the same thing we see across these things between different geographies. And, you know, Munger and Buffett also talked about when asked once before about what they wish they'd done differently, they said, we wish we'd gone further afield. And that's exactly what we try and do. So I don't look at pretty much any other company in France. I just look at Belor. So we look really, really cast the net really, really wide. But there's lots and lots of companies we just say, not interested, not interested, not interested. But then if an owner manager comes up that looks like is misunderstood, where the share price is depressed, then it looks like he's compounded capital over very long, long periods of time. You know, it looks like he's got a very unusual business model with a niche and speciality products. Then we're really interested. And equally, if there's a business that looks like it's got really low prices, but the customer loves the product, where they're passing on the economies of scale to the customer, we're like, oh, hang on a minute, we know this business model. And that's what we do. We don't really mind whether there's an element of geography where we probably don't tend to go to Japan, don't tend to go to South Korea. But, you know, if we sort of feel we can understand the business model, we don't really mind where it is. And the last thing I'd say is that what tends to happen in certain sectors, the stock market sort of doesn't get the business model, because JD Wetherspoon is different to every other pub company in the UK, because it tries to keep prices down, not prices up. And Ryanair was the same. I was an airlines analyst for 10 years, and Ryanair was in my sector, and I didn't understand it, because I didn't understand everyday low prices. I'm pretty embarrassed to admit that, but that's the truth of it. And so what's really interesting is when you then move around different sectors around the world, you can get these business models better than if you'll spend your life just stuck in one country or one sector, maybe. So, you know, we think it's a good way to sort of understand the models of companies rather than stuck in one country or one sector.
But how do you find them? I mean, are you screening by owner managers, or, you know, that it's just the vast array that you've got to cover in order to find these gems?
Yeah, it's sort of, people always ask us that question. Actually, that comes up all the time. And we did used to screen, and we used to screen quite a lot. So we used to screen what's called a Greenblatt model. Joel Greenblatt, a really smart investor, and he has a screen that looks at sort of return on capital against EV to EBIT. So we used to do that. And then we used to screen on Ben Graham and cheap stocks and that. And we haven't run those screens for years, actually. And now we have a screen that's in our heads that's basically called what also looks like that. And I know that sounds really, really bad. And the other way we do it is that Charlie Munger once famously said, when said, how do you find ideas? Charlie Munger famously once said, he said, there's three things I look for. He said, I look for the spin outs, which is look for when one company is being spun out of another. He said, I look for the cannibals, which is where a company is buying its own shares back. He said, and I look for what the other smart people are doing. And we don't look at spin outs very much, but we do look at what the other two are. You know, companies are buying their own shares back is a usually interesting sign. And we look at what other smart investors are doing. Not, you know, egregiously, but, you know, Charlie Munger recently bought shares in Alibaba. It was an interesting sign. So we did a bit of work on it. And I just think, you know, you've got time in the day, you can research something. You might not buy it for 3 years, but it's a way to look at something, get an idea on something. But yeah, it's just once you start to understand cannibals, companies that buy their own shares back, once you start to understand owner managers and what drives them, once you start to understand retained capital and businesses that retain the capital in the business and why they retain the capital and what they do with the capital, you start to see more and more business models. And then you look at one and go, oh no, not this time, maybe a bit expensive, but it's in your brain for next year or the year after or the year after. And so that's how we do it.
Interesting. So lots of fund managers have been selling Boohoo because of its ESG credentials, and you've been buying. Can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts around that?
I think Nick Sleep is probably one of the best managers that this country has ever had. And Nick Sleep said something, not about Boohoo, I forget which company he was talking about, but he said a really good expression, which is, he said, growth slows in a company the minute an analyst picks up his pen. And I think that's a brilliant expression. And I'm pretty much guilty of that, because I was a sell-side analyst for a long time. I still am to a degree. And I'm someone that's generally missed quite a lot of growth companies, in the sense that I knew Fevertree as a product when it came to the market, didn't buy the shares, knew Hargreaves Lansdown when it came to the market, didn't buy the shares. So I'm someone that's been too skeptical of number of growth companies. So I'm not a sort of growth junkie in that regard, and others are better than me in that. But I think what sometimes it's easy for us to miss as domestic investors is if we've got a company that has got a niche globally, but happens to be based domestically. So Ocado is perhaps a good example, or maybe the Lloyds insurance companies in the UK are a good example. And I think Boohoo and ASOS potentially are examples of that. They are businesses that just maybe have a global position in fast online fashion. And we seem to want to be asking lots of cynical questions of them rather than just admiring them for what they're doing. And And I think we've done a bit of work as much as we can on Shein, the Chinese competitor. And it's very interesting because Shein is a private company that's not being held to the same public account as Boohoo is recently. And of course, Shein's growing very quickly, but Boohoo is having to be held publicly to a lot of very difficult, not difficult, but to a lot of public ESG standards. And Shein is a private Chinese company that is not being having to held to any of those standards at all. So at some point, as is the case with Primark and Nike and everyone else, businesses are all having to be all have to be held to the same standards. So I just think it's interesting that we are sort of, as UK public shareholders, seeing it from a slightly cynical eye. And the other thing I'd say about Boohoo is that, you know, we did a bit of work on it. And what interests us about Boohoo as a business model is that we've done quite a lot of work on Frasers because it's a company we've known for a long time. And we think there's some analogies between the two because Boohoo's purchase of a lot of brands is very analogous to what Sports Direct did in purchasing brands and rolling them into its own store in terms of the purchasing of Slazenger and Dunlop and so on. And Sports Direct at that time built a lot of power and a lot of pricing power and margin and all the rest of it in terms of driving those brands through its own store base. And Boohoo is doing exactly the same in terms of driving those brands through its own online distribution base. So we just think there's some very interesting sort of dynamics at work here. And again, there is another owner manager driving the business. And again, there is another sort of, you know, potentially non-perfect story in terms of ESG as per Frasers. And we just think it's very easy to throw the baby out with the bathwater rather than just admire these people for what they're doing and the businesses they're building. And I suppose if there's another message I'd give sort of, you know, people that are interested in what we're doing in terms of running the fund is that we really, really like sort of owner managers. We really like the alignment with owner managers that we have in terms of trying to investments that we're making. And what we probably do is we don't mind aligning ourselves with an owner manager that might have a little bit more hair on him or a little bit more foibles about them if we feel the alignment is genuine and if we're getting enough value. And people will see that we've got an investment in Frasers in the fund, you know, and we're not going to apologize for that. We think Mike Ashley is a very, very interesting entrepreneur and we purchased the shares at a very, very good price. And we don't have a problem with the investment we've made in Boohoo for exactly the same basis. And I think that there is a job here to do, which is to align yourself with money-making entrepreneurs. Yes, to ask questions of them, but to not, as I said before, throw the baby out with the bathwater.
But don't you think the sentiment around fast fashion has changed a bit, like sugar in soft drinks, for example, has changed?
I think it, yeah, I think I can understand why you asked that, but I think if it's also worth looking at the work that these people are doing in terms of, you know, we sort of communicated something on this recently, which was in order to get people to appeal to fast fashion, you need to get the brand out there and you need to get the pricing out there. So that's how someone will buy a dress for the first time around. But in order to get someone to go back to buy that dress or that brand for the third, fourth, sixth, seventh time, you need to have a depth to that relationship. And the depth of that relationship is probably the supply chain. It is probably recycling. It is probably sourcing and all the rest of it. And that is what Boohoo have been spending a lot of time and a lot of money on in the last 18 months, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And that is the thing where someone like Shein is behind them on. I think investors just need to bear in mind there are two sides to this. So if you're going to criticize a company for not perhaps having credentials for sustainable sourcing, then that's fine. But on the other side, you can't then equally criticize the company for potentially having a competitor that's growing faster than you, which is Shein, the private company in China, who is growing faster than Boohoo right now, which is what some investors are nervous about. But then Shein probably almost certainly does not have sustainable sourcing. All I'm trying to get at is you today, it feels like Boohoo is being criticized for two completely opposing stories at the same time, i.e., not having sustainable sourcing and not growing as fast as someone else that definitely doesn't have sustainable sourcing. I hope that's clear.
Thank you. And so what of your holdings in the fund are you most excited about?
I sigh because I know the one I should talk about and I know it's the most controversial. Okay, the one I am the most excited about is Biglari Holdings. And I say that quite rightly because it is the one that we have the biggest position in. But it is, the UK investors will not know Biglari Holdings, but investors in the UK, in the US will know Biglari Holdings. A long story short is that people will know Warren Buffett and they'll know of the Warren Buffett story. Some investors might know a gentleman called Henry Singleton and the story of Teledyne Holdings. So if they read back in the course of history, Henry Singleton has as good a reputation as Warren Buffett in the 1960s and the 1970s. And he achieved just as good, if not better, compound returns as Warren Buffett. And people like Warren Buffett have spoken incredibly glowingly about Henry Singleton. Okay. And Henry Singleton achieved fantastic compound returns by basically buying companies, building the business up, and then cancelling shares when the share price was depressed. Okay. But Henry Singleton was no Warren Buffett. Henry Singleton was not all warm and cuddly and didn't constantly tell shareholders all about his business all of the time. Okay. Whether he was like a Mike Ashley or not is I couldn't really tell you, but he was definitely someone who was a little bit more economic with the truth. He was a little bit more quiet with what was going on with his businesses, and therefore his share price was often or sometimes mispriced, and therefore he bought a lot of his shares back at low prices. But ultimately, when judged many years afterwards, everyone loves the fact that he built fantastic compound growth per share. Okay. I believe, controversially, potentially to some people in America, that Biglari, Sadiq Biglari, who owns 65% of Biglari Holdings, is in the process of building a Henry Singleton-type vehicle. I think the market cap that's judged on Bloomberg of $520 million is wrong. I think the market cap of the company is more like $250 million. And the reason I say that is because inside Biglari Holdings is a fund, and in that fund, they have purchased their own shares, and this is all disclosed in the report and accounts, which is why I think that the market cap of the company is different in terms of that that's stated in onto Bloomberg and in terms of Yahoo Finance. It's not simple. It requires a lot of work, a lot of analysis. We've been looking at the company probably for 4 or 5 years. There is no analyst coverage of the company. But I think that this is a very unusual, very fascinating company and a very unusual and fascinating entrepreneur. Not only is he someone that's a very good investor, bought shares in different companies that have gone up many, many times in terms of the investment appreciation they've made. But he's also someone that's proved himself to be a very interesting and capable person in terms of turning around businesses. He's bought an oil business out of bankruptcy. He's bought a business that's like a Steak and Shake business, which is a burger franchise, which was a franchise business. I think he's got some fascinating skills. I think the business today is worth 3 times the current share price. And I think the business then will still compound at 12 to 20% per annum. But there's a lot of people in the New York investing community that don't like him for lots and lots of different reasons that I'm not going to go into here.
So is it an investment company a bit like Berkshire Hathaway?
It is a bit like Berkshire Hathaway. It's called Biglari Holdings, as in BH, but like Berkshire Hathaway. It reports its results on the same day as Berkshire Hathaway. The business has effectively been modelled on Berkshire Hathaway, and the investment community of New York effectively, because for a period of time, Biglari Holdings was seen to be a sort of next Berkshire Hathaway and then failed or disappointed for a period of time. That is why, if you like, it sort of it had a fall from grace. So it is exactly like Berkshire Hathaway and has been modelled on Berkshire Hathaway. They've even bought 3 insurance companies to build float just like Berkshire Hathaway. So yes, it is modelled very much on that basis.
And what failed?
What failed is they bought a business called Steak and Shake, which was a bit like Shake Shack. They bought it for a very low price. They turned the business around from poor like-for-like sales to good like-for-like sales. And then the business sort of tailed off in terms of had poor sales for a period of time, not just in the pandemic, but pre the pandemic. They also bought a business called Maxim, which was a sort of lads magazine, that which didn't manage to turn around at all. What also failed is that Sadiq Beglari is a very, very prickly individual. And he is not a warm and cuddly individual. And his relationship with the investment community is, how do we put it? Frosty at best, let's put it that way. He used to have his investment meetings in Manhattan, and they were awful because basically at one stage there was a potential takeover of the company where a number of people tried to get rid of him and tried to oust him from the company, and he managed to defeat that takeover. But that caused a huge amount of animosity between him and those people that tried to take him over. So he fought that takeover and defeated the takeover. But what now happens, he has his investment meetings in Austin near his home, and actually they're a much, much more calmer affair. But yes, there was a period of time of 3 or 4 years where he and a number of activist shareholders were absolutely at each other's throats, and it was a pretty toxic period of time.
And of markets generally, which market do you think is most undervalued throughout the world at the moment?
In terms of which markets are interesting, I mean, I'm just sort of take a slightly contrarian view. I think South Africa looks interesting to me. South Africa is always a market that's actually got some interesting sort of high return on capital employed stocks, and the stock market's performed poorly there for a very long time. So sort of naturally find it interesting, but I don't know that many stocks there well. Again, from a contrarian view, I think what's going on in China in terms of sort of the anti-regulation view there is interesting. And I think the UK, don't particularly have a strong view on sort of market levels or large cap stocks in the UK, but I think the companies that are exposed to sort of recovery and consumption in the UK, I think are probably poised quite well. I think some of those have already performed well, but I think there's probably some more of that to come. So those are the bits that I'd be sort of the most exposed, I'm sorry, not the most exposed, but the most interested in. And I think I sort of referred to earlier on, I think for me, things where you've got a recovery in consumer spending and sort of, you know, anything that's a beneficiary of sort of reduction in the savings ratio. I just think there's whether it's a sort of a booming 20s type period to come, whether that's inflationary or not, I can't really say. But I just think certainly there is a propensity to spend, I think, is not something I'd be, I'd be underestimating in the sort of coming few years.
And do you think we'll still continue to see such bid activity in the UK?
I'm not surprised with what we've seen, in the sense that I think there was a period of time where absolute valuations in comparison to the intrinsic value of businesses did look a bit crazy. And I think it's always very interesting when out of that suddenly sort of private transactions arrive. So I'm not at all surprised that that's happened. And I wouldn't be surprised if that sort of carries on. And I think it's always an interesting sign when a stock market sort of has seen no activity and then suddenly sort of private equity or LBO type activity takes place. It shows you that mispricings are certainly there. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if we saw more, or at least a continuation of it, no.
Andrew, many thanks indeed for a fantastic interview. Tell our listeners where they can find out more about you and more about the fund.
No, not at all. Thanks very much for your time. If they go onto the Holland Advisors website, there's a fund page there where they can read about the fund. We wrote sort of an open letter ahead of the fund launch. People can read that if they're interested. The fund's quoted on Hargreaves Lansdown and AJ Bell. It's called the VT Holland Advisors Equity Fund. And also on our own website, there's quite a lot of free research on there. And there's a sort of investor education section, which people are kindly say nice things about. It's all free. So you can either have a look at that and just enjoy it, or you can sign up to receive updates on that as well. And that's the hollandadvisors.co.uk.
And I have to endorse, the education on the site is absolutely fabulous. And to all our listeners, many thanks for joining us. You can find over 100 investor interviews at piworld.co.uk/PI Wisdom as a video or as a podcast. And please subscribe to receive a notification of a new video as they're published, and no spam. And please keep us motivated to continue producing these interviews by liking, retweeting, or commenting on the content. It means a lot to us. We're now taking a break for the rest of the summer, and we'll be back with more PI World interviews in the autumn. In the meantime, enjoy the holidays, stay well, and we'll catch up with you soon.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.